The war against fuel, food, faith and freedom. Well, food and fuel are absolutely essential. Food is essential for life and fuel is essential for any advanced civilization society. Faith, absolutely essential for life and eternity. And of course, freedom, it's not much worth being here without it. All these four are under attack by the New World Disorder, and we are seeing it in an accelerating way in these days. Just a short while ago, an explosion, two explosions, three, then we hear four explosions in the North Sea, in the Baltic Sea, just off the coast of Denmark, not far from Sweden, and suddenly one of these massive eruptions of gas, toxic, spread coming out, a kilometer wide, and another one 200 meters wide. Four different explosions registered on seismic meters as must-be explosions. Now, these were obviously sabotaged. This is natural gas coming from Russia to Germany and a vital part of Germany's energy needs just before winter. And there were explosions, Nord Stream 2 definitely taken out, Nord Stream 1 significantly damaged but repairable, they say, in fairly short term. Well, the details were pretty clear as it came out. And interestingly, there'd been a whole lot of helicopter activity of Seahawks of the US Navy in that very area just the day or two before. Now, these are very, very serious steel and concrete reinforced pipes. It's not easy to get a blast there. This isn't something some farmer could do. You need, because most of this would be down at 100 meters. And when you're doing basic scuba diving training, 20 meters is about the depth extent of what a basic scuba diver goes. Much more beyond that, you need pretty advanced. When you're talking about underwater operations at 80 to 100 meters below the surface, the pressure is enormous. And you might not have scuba divers that could do it. You might need submarines and underwater vehicles. At any rate, this represents billions of dollars or billions of euros, if you prefer, of investment in the pipeline. And it also represents it the largest single asset economically for Russia in terms of the amount of money they could get into the country. In fact, most of Russia's income comes from exporting fuel, natural gas, oil, and coal. And, of course, they could just turn the taps off, which they did earlier this year to put pressure on Europe because Europe was putting sanctions on them. President Biden immediately said, of course, the Russians did it. This is an own goal. Putin blew up his own pipeline, which you'd wonder why, because all he had to do was turn the taps off. Why would you remove your own asset, your economic asset that he could use to put leverage on Europe to force Europe to do what he wanted to do or not do all the bad things they wanted to do. Interestingly enough, I should say that earlier this year, Biden said if Russia invades Ukraine, if tanks cross the border, then Nord Stream 2 will be finished. And they said, well, how exactly can you do it? It's not in your control. He says, he smiled and he said, don't worry, we can do it. It'll be gone. There'll be no more Nord Stream 2. And Victoria Nuland, a State Department character who brought about, organized, funded, to the tune of billions of dollars, the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine back in 2014, she also said, Nord Stream 2 is finished. You know, it's going to be gone because Russia's... And, of course, it's one way to hurt Russia economically enormously. So you've got on record two senior members of the US government who said before and they're going to do it. But, and in fact, the previous Minister for Defense in Poland sent out a tweet, thank you USA, for the picture of this explosion, because interesting timing, would you believe it, that the day after the bombing of Nord Stream 2, they opened the new Baltic Pipeline project, which brings natural gas from Norway, and it's partly controlled by the USA and so on, and that's coming into Poland. So In fact, how interesting, their main competitor got blown up the day before they launched this new Baltic pipeline. Obviously coincidence, but just mention. Now, we are told in 1 Chronicles 12, verse 32, that we need to understand the times and know what God's people need to do. The men of Issachar understood the times and knew what God's people need to do. 1 Chronicles 12 has a listing of all the different mighty men of David, different soldiers. And, you know, you read of tens of thousands of these and 100,000 of those, and armed with swords and spears and bows and all the different weapons. And then you read, and then there's just this 120 men of Issachar who understood the times and knew what Israel should do. Well, why even mention them? Are they even significant? Well, they're like the intelligence corps, the strategists, the ones who understand the times and know what the people should do. Because all that military is not very effective if they aren't well directed at the right time, the right place, and so on. So God's people are encouraged to understand the times, to recognize the signs of the times, to rightly divide the word of truth, to work out what is going on in the world. At this time of escalating war in Ukraine, seriously escalating, international tensions, economic sabotage of massive scales, engineered shortages of almost every form of fuel imaginable and of food, diminishing food security, and disrupted fuel supply and fuel and food supply chains. Suddenly, you have blockages, borders like this, just the N3 in Natal, KZN. And suddenly, this absolute backlog because of burning vehicles, burning tires, looting of this and that, and roads being closed. This massively disrupts, because most of the food supplies we have don't come by train. It comes by freight truck, Pentechnicas, 18-wheelers. And we know how that can be disrupted. This is the main land bridge from Russia to Crimea. And it was blown up just a week ago. So what is the globalist agenda behind all these ominous developments? Very serious, ominous, escalating. And you've got people talking about nuclear war, talking about, you have to believe this to see it. New York put out some stupid video with some actress smiling away at the camera. In the event of a nuclear attack, there's three things you got to do. Go inside, stay far away from the windows, and stay inside. And then listen to the news. I mean, you've got to be kidding. And they're distributing iodine tablets. Wow. And that's really going to solve the problem, isn't it? In fact, as was well put, the people who survive a nuclear blast are going to envy the dead, because it's not the people who die instantly in a nuclear exchange that suffer. The ones who left behind, not just the radiation. Radiation is bad enough, but the nuclear clouds, which would make crop failures and which would reduce the Earth's temperature dramatically to points where many people would not be able to survive. And there would be colossal famine. People would starve to death. You couldn't grow crops. There would not be sunshine. I mean, forget your solar panels, things like that, if you're in those areas where this is taking place. There's so many after effects that a nuclear exchange would be absolutely catastrophic and ruin civilization in Northern Hemisphere for a very long time. And yet, you're having these people talking about, I mean, in the event of a nuclear strike, go inside, stay away from the windows, stay inside, listen to the news. What news? Do you really think after nuclear exchange is going to be broadcast and just an EMP? You don't even have to kill anyone with a nuclear strike. You can organize an EMT, an electromagnetic pulse, which is a very low yield form of nuclear. It doesn't have to kill anyone. You can set off, say, the height of a satellite, way above Europe, Central Europe. You could kill all computers, radios, everything electronic, including vehicles, aircraft. So just an electromagnetic pulse. I mean, what do they think? That the radio is going to be broadcasting what to do and so on New York after they've had a strike. And then this woman afterwards, giving these three things, she smiles at the camera and says, "You got this." Who produces idiotic propaganda like that? How can anyone have an upside of a nuclear war? But they're trying. people in America and in Britain are talking about, we must get used to this being a 10 to 50 year war in Ukraine. Key people in the British government, heads in the military, generals, this is going to be at least a 10 to 50 year war. Are they insane? Is this really a brilliant idea? Who benefits? Well, the military industrial complex might benefit, but the poor souls on the ground, civilian and military, they do not benefit. Interestingly enough, earlier this year, at the World Government Summit 2022, Klaus Schwab said, history is truly at a turning point. He's used the word Great Reset before, there's just another phrase in it. We do not yet know the full extent and systemic structural changes which will happen. However, we do know that the global energy systems, food systems, and supply chains will be deeply affected. And Klaus Schwab said, the answer to the global food and energy crisis is to expand government power. In other words, the solution to global problems is global government. Now, they create the global famines, they create the global energy shortages, and then they say, we've got the solution, global government. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, Hegelian dialectic. Create the problem, offer the solution, hey presto. They author the problems, they initiate the problems, they aggravate the problems, and then they offer the solution, which is what they wanted to do, chase everyone into global government. David Rockefeller said famously about 40 years ago, all we need is the right major crisis and nations will accept the New World Order. And you might recall 1991, we had George Bush Sr. saying that this Iraqi invasion of Kuwait offers us a chance to impose the New World Order, or bring about the New World Order. And interesting, the three main pillars of the New World Order that the global elite want to bring about are one world economy, a one world government, and a one world interfaith religion. And the shorthand to describe this is globalism. Now, this should ring a few bells, you know, like Revelation 13, one world government, one world religion, one world economic system. Everyone's got to get a mark. Without this, you can't buy or sell. I mean, it's sort of some Pavlovian bells ringing somewhere in the dark recesses. Seems to ring a bell somewhere. Now, President Vladimir Putin has likened the European Union's attempts to cut itself off from Russian fossil fuel to economic suicide. And actually it is. Because do you know how the Cold War was won? There was a lot of reasons, but one of the elements to it was Ronald Reagan, he waged war on many fronts against the Soviet Union, but one of the strategies was to bring down the price of fuel so dramatically that Russia would lose its number one foreign exchange earning. And so he conspired with OPEC nations on to glut the market with more and more and more fuel to bring the prices down. And Russia, which depended on the foreign exchange to earn from exporting fuel, lost a lot of money. And at the same time, he started a massive arms race and then the space race, and Russia couldn't keep up with it, and they bankrupted themselves in it. And this led to a complete social collapse. So now we've got Biden doing the exact opposite. He's driving the price of fuel way up to such an extent that Russia's getting richer and richer. In fact, because Russia's a major oil exporting country. And so the ruble has strengthened since the war began and sanctions began. The pound's gone down. The dollar's gone down. Most European currencies have gone down. The euro's gone down. But the ruble's going up. And you think, but he's under sanctions. Yes, but he's able to sell his fuel to, because India's happy to buy. In fact, the entire third world's happy to buy. They're having no problems at all selling their oil. And in fact, Europe's dependent on his gas and all the rest of it. So as Putin says, what Europe's doing is economic suicide. And in fact, it is. They're heading into a very cold, dark winter. And the dollar's not doing particularly well. Anthony Sutton wrote many years ago about the energy that created crisis. And they started that crisis back, you could recall, back in the 70s. And every now and then they intensified. I remember when my father used to stop at the petrol station and ask for 50 cents of fuel. And that wasn't being silly. You could get quite a lot of fuel for 50 cents. And I remember when I started my motorbike mission, I think it cost something like 32 cents a litre. And I could drive up to on my 250 motorbike to Johannesburg for approximately 34 rand fuel cost. And at that stage, I think an air ticket from Cape Town to Joburg was something like 42 rand, if I remember right. I'm talking about 1981. So interesting, the created crisis of energy. And then China and the global energy crisis. Do you know 70% of all green energy batteries, solar panels, and wind farms come from China? Red China is getting stinking rich on this green energy deal, and they're the worst polluters of the planet. And by the way, it's a lot of environmental degradation to make those batteries and wind farms and so on. Understand the global energy crisis. These help us to understand what's going on right now. We're heading into the biggest global energy crisis ever. The ongoing energy crisis in Europe is going to be a long one and will extend way past the next year and the year beyond, possibly beyond that. And this is a warning from the Hungarian Foreign Minister, Peter Cetsaro, following a meeting of EU energy ministers this last week, Wednesday. That is why the Hungarian government pays special attention to ensuring the physical and legal functioning of the Turkish stream, as this is of fundamental interest to our national security. Without energy, your national security is undermined. You need food and you need fuel, or your country's not energy independent. And he said Hungarian gas storage facilities are filled at 48% of the annual consumption, so they've got enough to last half a year in storage. But the average fill for Europe is at the moment about 26.9%, which is not adequate, about a quarter of the year supply. They're heading into a very dark winter. Hungary receives about 80% of its gas from Russia's gas giant Gazprom. And while Russia's cut off gas supplies to a number of countries, Hungary has signed a deal with Moscow late August for additional deliveries on top of the already agreed for volume. So Hungary is not participating in the boycott and the sanctions of Russia because they see it's not in their economic self-interest to do so. Hungarian President Viktor Orban, who just won another term in office, had previously accused the EU leadership of sparking the ongoing energy crisis by introducing counterproductive sanctions on Russian energy over Moscow's ongoing military campaign in Ukraine. It's basically Europe is hurting itself more because it's so dependent on Russian energy sources that the sanctions on Russia is actually hurting them more than it's hurting Russia. Russia's doing a roaring trade, selling all over the world. India, which is one of the biggest customers, is thoroughly happy to be getting the deal from Russia and Brazil and all over the world. You can see that, in fact, the entire world outside of North America and Europe and Western Europe are ignoring the sanctions. It's just a Western Europe and EU-NATO deal. The rest of the world is happily trading with Russia without a problem, including South Africa. Budapest has repeatedly called for the failed policies of Brussels to be changed, and they note that sanctions don't fulfill the hope that was pinned on him. Sanctions has not changed anything as far as pressuring Russia to change the policies. But Europe is slowly bleeding. In fact, Europe is bleeding, and there's protest brewing all over and there's revolt. We're now seeing the first global energy crisis in history. And it's long term. That's what the Hungarian Minister for Energy declared. Explained that the crisis is being fueled, if you can use the term, by the underlying structural geopolitical reasons tied to security, which require long-term solutions. What he means is, by the EU and NATO waging a proxy war against Russia through Ukraine, basically what they're doing is they're cutting off their central supplies and they are endangering the long-term security of Europe. Now, it's also been pointed out that this Nord Stream oil pipeline was particularly an arrangement between Russia and Germany. And Germany is going to suffer a lot because Germany is an industrial nation. And towards the end of the Second World War, there was the so-called Morgenthau Plan, which was to deindustrialize Germany to such an extent that it would cause about 30 million people to die of starvation. They said, you know, basically cripple the country. And this was a serious plan endorsed by Winston Churchill and by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And they hoped to basically destroy Germany, completely strip the Ruhr of all industries and force it to be an agricultural country, which it couldn't survive at because Germany's too small, too many people there. There's no way that they could survive without. And so about 30 million people would die, but that was the Morgenthau plan. Well, Germany's a very industrialized country right now, biggest car exporter on the planet. And the goal is maybe a second Morgenthau plan through entering into this winter, all the energy they need, they can't get. What could the, and they can't even negotiate with Russia now, because they were sitting at the negotiating table about reopening Nord Stream 2 when it got blown up. So, intriguing, coincidental. But the American Secretary of State said, this is an opportunity to force Europe off its dependence on fossil fuels. So, it's basically a second Morgan II plan. Deindustrialize Europe, because you can't run an advanced industrial society without lots of energy, cheap and reliable energy, fuel. And at the moment, fossil fuels are still the mainstay of it, because they don't want to use nuclear power, and there's no way wind turbines and solar panels are going to do the job, certainly not in Europe, if they don't have that much sunshine in winter. Very interesting thing happened in this last week in Parliament. During a question-answer session, President Cyril Ramaphosa was confronted about earlier promises that load shedding had come to an end. I mean, in fact, you remember even way back with Jacob Zuma opening up the new plant and saying, never, 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 never again will there ever be load shedding in South Africa, because they had this massive plant. Unfortunately, it didn't work very well. So in his reply, the president replied that the people with the necessary skills have left Eskom. No jokes. They fired 18,700 engineers because they're the wrong color. And they're now being recruited from around the world to come and help resolve the crisis. So they kicked out 18,700 qualified engineers because they were white. And hey presto, Ramaphosa first described what an excellent institution Eskom once was, one of the best public utility companies in the world, which is true. It was recognized even in New York newspapers, Washington Post and so on, that worldwide, South Africa, I think, had the second cheapest energy in the world and the most reliable with Eskom. Now we're going back to the 80s. Then he described the confidence the enormous Medupi power plant instilled in him before it had been completed. But later he realized the project not only cost a lot more than had been budgeted, but also could not meet the expectations due to design flaws. That's putting it nicely. It didn't work. Then Ramaphosa reiterated an early admission, the 1990s decision by Mandela that Eskom would not build any more power stations as a root of the current power problem. Shortly after Mandela became president in 1994, Eskom came to him and said, we need to start building right now. And they put forward, I think, six new power plants. And it's going to, because in 10 years' time, we are going to start having power failures. The projected growth and expansion, we will not manage beyond 10 years. And Mandela said, don't worry about it, because he wasn't going to be in office for 10 years from now. And so he told them, and they said, but you can't do this short term. It takes about 10 years from beginning till it's able to be producing electricity for a good, effective power station. We've got to start right now. And he just ignored it and said, don't worry about it. And Mbeki also kicked the ball down the road. And it was left up to Zuma finally when we started to have all our power failures. And it started in 2005. That's the first citywide power failure we had in Cape Town. Totally unexpected. And then 2008, it started to become a regular. And if you might recall, Zuma put Ramaphosa in charge of fixing Eskom. Most people have forgotten that. Well, Ramaphosa then added that personnel with the capabilities to plan, execute these projects had consequently left Eskom. Yeah, well, they had actually been laid off because they were the wrong color. And with the load shedding crisis, I love the word load shedding, it's just the government's got so much electricity, they're giving it away free. I mean, load shedding suggests, you know, I've got extra, would you like more? This is a power failure, it's a blackout, it's load shedding, what? Now, how they've got us to accept some euphemism for government failure. It's a scheduled power failure. When the realization came that Eskom will indeed need to increase its generation capacity, the personnel with the necessary skills were no longer available. No, they were working in the Netherlands and Dubai and so on. The enormous Medupi and Kusile power plants, which were supposed to solve the problem, were undertaken with foreign expertise. Remember, this was the main area of state capture and corruption. A new admission is that the expertise needed to combat the mismanagement and corruption and to protect Eskom's interests in general were no longer in the organization either. They chased away all the experienced staff, people with decades of experience, who knew the job, who understood it, didn't just have the qualifications, had the experience and a track record. Therefore, planning errors, I mean, I'm still quoting from El Presidente, planning errors and corruption largely went unnoticed and could only be seen in delayed completions and budget overruns. It all eventually, budget overruns, like to the tune of billions and hundreds of billions, it all eventually came to light when the power plants came online and failed. Well, no jokes, and who could have foreseen that? According to Ramaphosa, former personnel have since been recruited worldwide to remedy the situation in South Africa, like the engineers that were kicked out of Coburg Nuclear Power Station. They had to be recruited. They were now in the Netherlands, and they had a zero to their salary when it came back to be advisors. Yeah, they'd had engineers in Coburg, but they hadn't done any of the maintenance. And Coburg Nuclear Power Station, 2005, November 2005, almost melted down, which was a very serious lack of maintenance. And they had people qualified, they just weren't experienced. He made no mention of Solidarity's list of 300 engineers who were available to help, but only 18 had been appointed as of last week. Still, quoting from Ramaphosa, it's important to note that the exodus of expertise was not just as a result of Eskom's changed priorities, but also due to affirmative action that was aggressively implemented. So Ramaphosa actually admitted that affirmative action caused the problem. Experience is not something that can be replaced by potential. Yes, these people might have the potential and they might even have the qualifications, but experience is worth a hang of a lot more than any university degree. So affirmative appointments ought to rise through the ranks and learn on the way. You can't get experience overnight. With his description of Eskom's former glory and his admission that former employees were considered an important part of the solution, Ramaphosa's actually admitting that affirmative action forced the country's economies to its knees and crippled our growth, our abilities, destroyed how many people's businesses, impoverished all of our lives. At COP26 in Glasgow last November, Britain, United States, France and Germany and the rest of the EU joined together to allocate $8.5 billion. That's not Zimbabwe dollars, that's American dollars. $8.5 billion in seed money to South Africa. Why? South Africa is the key to the green energy plan for the third world, they say. It's the world's first just energy transition partnership, JETP. They just can't stop creating new companies and initiatives. A crucial effort to lower carbon footprints. This money, billions of dollars, is being given to the South African government, who's already stolen $4 trillion, by the way, in corruption. The money is meant to allow South Africa to retire a colossal but creaking and corruption-ridden fleet of coal plants. But they're still producing energy. No, close them down. The workers will now need to find new jobs. I mean, just in the coal belt of Mpumalanga, there's over 120,000 workers full-time employed in coal production, coal mining, and transportation. They'll have to find new work, but don't worry about that. The region's already got a 35% unemployment rate, but green energy is the way to go. Shut down the coal plants. So one of the biggest coal plants in Africa has just been shut down this last month, Komati. The country must focus on concentrating and reskilled because there's great skepticism that the high-tech jobs in green energy or electrical vehicles will go to former miners. They say, just convert Komati, a coal-burning plant, into a green energy solar panel plant. You think you can just retrain 120,000 workers into this? If South Africa can pull this off, though, it'll become a template for action elsewhere, they said. So the coal plants produce 84% of our energy are being run by Eskom Holdings. And this gigantic public utility has been failing for almost two decades now. And not just failing financially. Most of the power plants are not well maintained. I mean, every time there's a power failure, what do you hear? The coal was wet. The conveyor belt broke down. There was more demand for electricity than had been anticipated. And they keep coming out with, it's like, you know, the dog ate my homework and all that sort of thing. Although now we could say, Eskom lost my homework because I was dealing with, and then we had a power failure and I lost my work. So Same sort of thing. Dog ate my homework. This year, the worst ever, with South Africans suffering through more power failure blackouts called load shedding than ever before. Considered uninvestable by international finance, Eskom's a drag on the whole economy as it soaks up massive, colossal government subsidies. Kamati Power Station, for 60 years, one of South Africa's largest coal plants, its last coal-burning unit has just been turned off. They're converting this to solar energy. How is that going to work out? Oh, and by the way, it's that solar energy is not going to go to people who used to be getting electricity from this coal-burning plant. No. A new workshop's already making containerized solar microgrids, and these are going to be repurposed shipping crates or containers full of batteries powered by solar panels that will be deployed to far-flung rural communities currently off the electricity grid. So this is not going to help the people on the grid right now. This is for people who are not on the grid. So what's going to happen to those thousands of businesses and millions of homes that used to get the electricity from Kamati? Don't worry about them. I mean, you've got to think of the big picture here. Eskom also wants Kamati to make agrivoltaics. Have you heard of agrivoltaics before? Solar panels erected in fields instead of growing crops. So this is what you call a solar farm. You don't grow mealie-meal or anything like that. No, you grow solar panels. And the utility will lease land around the power plant for solar farms. What happens to the people who used to eat the food that came from those farms? Don't worry about that. Now, we know that municipalities are inherently corrupt. I mean, just take Cape Town Municipality, which is meant to be the best municipality in the country. But that's a pretty poor standard. They are still charging us 800% water tariff for water because of the drought that ended 5 years ago. They've never brought it down. They hiked it up to 800% because of the so-called water crisis, which was just mismanagement. And, billions and billions of rands overcharged. We've never been refunded, have we? But Eskom, on one occasion, had 139 billion rand theft. I don't know that anyone's been called to account, and I don't believe they've recovered any of it. But they've not just lost hundreds of billions in SAA and Eskom, they've lost trillions. This government is estimated to have stolen 4.4 trillion rands worth of public money. So, what does 4 trillion rand look like? 4.4 trillion. I don't have it in rands, but I've got it in dollars. Serves same purpose. This is 100, let's assume 100 rand note. This is 10,000. So it's, you could fit it in your pocket. So 1,000. There you've got 100 bills, and it's 10,000. You can fit it in your pocket. This is 1 million. And you could put that in a shopping bag. Here is 100 million. Fits on a pallet, like a ton. We handle pallets here all the time. Okay, here's 1 billion rand. That's 10 pallets. Here's 1 trillion. Those are double stacked. Double stacked. And it's enough space to fill a football field. It's bigger than a wingspan and tail to nose span of a 747 jumbo jet. Four times that plus is how much the ANC government has stolen from the taxpayers in this country through corruption. According to the African Union's Task Force on Corruption, 32% of the GDP is stolen every year by government. 32%. That is 10 times more than all the foreign aid we get. So let's get this straight. I'm paying taxes on my wages, and then paying sales tax to spend my own money, and then paying income tax on the money that was already taxed. And when I die, my kids pay the death tax on the money that was already taxed. Yep. And they find other ways to get you as well. Like the government gets more money out of every litre of fuel you buy than the petrol producing country, the petrol company, and the petrol station combined. The government gets more. But you can believe in unicorns and solar energy solving all the problems and wind farms, which kill tens of thousands of birds every year. I mean, these wind farms are actually a catastrophe. They're not just ugly as hell. They actually are often, because of the wind, where they get the most wind, it's in the flight plan of many of the birds. So many migrating birds get whacked by these turbines. Not good. And by the way, where do electric cars get the energy from? They asked a CEO of an electric car company in California, where do you get the electricity for your batteries? And I said, from the building. And someone else from the city said, well, actually, it's from our coal plant, which powers the electricity in the building. So they literally are telling you this is going to save the planet. It takes far more to make that battery. And these batteries don't last as long as you know. As some of us have to replace batteries regularly, don't we, Angela? And continually, you've got to replace these batteries. And the cost of them, it's more degradation on the environment than the fossil fuels. And so here's more electric car fuel headed for the power plant. Because even in California, where they make it mandatory to have electric cars, and they're going to ban all fossil fuel cars, they're already putting legislation there for that. And they've had to tell people not to charge electric cars overnight because it's going to put too much strain on the electricity grid in California. We can start telling our friends in America and Europe how to prepare for load shedding because they have not experienced power failures before and they're heading to it. Decades ago, early 90s, I came across this book, Lords of Poverty. Absolutely staggering. The freewheeling lifestyles, power, prestige, and corruption, a multi-billion dollar aid industry. I mean, what we're talking about? UNESCO, World Food Program, and all these other different groups that are there to feed the starving. They are making a mint out of the starvation of people. Lords of Poverty. Now, this is a scandal that goes back, and I've seen it. I've been in Operation Lifeline Sudan, right there in Sudan, and seen these people having 11, 12 course meals at Operation Lifeline Sudan on the brink of famine, where people are dying of starvation by the hundreds of thousands a year. And the people organizing the food program it was surreal. It was beyond that. It was bizarre. It was disgusting. You could not believe the lavishness of the lifestyles of the people who are living on caring for the poor. Reminds you of Judas, who rebuked the woman who anointed Jesus with perfume, said, why was this ointment not sold and the money given to the poor? And John's gospel said, Judas wasn't concerned for the poor. Judas was in charge of money bags and Judas was a thief. And that's, unfortunately, the model for a lot of these aid agencies. Well, you might have noticed that just a short while ago, President of the United States went to OPEC leader, the King of Saudi Arabia, to plead with him to increase oil production. Remember, America was oil sufficient when he came to power, but he stopped just about all local production and made America dependent on foreign energy. And what was the result? Well, we were informed, was it just a week ago, by Saudi Arabia that OPEC countries are going to be producing 2 billion barrels of oil less every day. Billion, with a B. 2 billion barrels of oil less. They were cutting production. That's per day, not... That would have been bad. I would have thought of that's per year. They're cutting production by 2 billion barrels of oil per day less. Which, what is that going to do? Do the exact opposite of what Biden had apparently asked them. I mean, that's assuming that he was really asking for what they've said and isn't working with them to do this. Who knows? I mean, there's a lot of duplicity in government. But what's this going to do? If you have less of something, the prices go up. So it's going to drive the price of fuel even higher. And so OPEC is cutting production by the biggest production cuts that have happened in our lifetime. This is not good news as Europe and North America heads into an energy crisis. OPEC is playing along with the deal, but I can't help but believe that this is also part of the World Economic Forum's plan. It's hard to... Maybe Biden did ask him to increase production. That's what they said he did. But on the other hand, maybe they... Who knows what they're saying behind closed doors? This might be fitting into their plan anyway. But it all heads towards a serious, seriously cold, dark winter in the Northern Hemisphere in particular. And this goes along with the war on farmers. War on fuel, war on food. Now remember, what runs the world? Food and fuel. And faith and freedom. But the WEF wants to say that what runs the world is food, fuel, and finance. Now, you can't eat Bitcoin and dollar notes and euros. So finance, a lot of it's smoke and mirrors and blips on a computer screen and artificially created debts and all that stuff. Finance is very helpful in international trade and so on, but finance can't keep you alive, actually, when it comes down to basic survival. Commodities can. Cash is not as important as commodities. Russia has commodities. They have food and they have fuel. The West farmed out a lot of those things, but they've got cash. Well, what if they all say, well, we're not going to use your cash. Forget the petrodollar. We're all going to trade in rubles and yen, and BRICS is going to create a new order. Well, this could cause a real problem. But anyway, let's just look at the farmers. Under the guise of the COVID-19 lockdowns, governments initiated an engineered collapse of the global food supply chain to starve the public into compliance. Widespread famine and starvation are coming, and food will be used as a weapon to manufacture compliance. When people are starving, well, this is what was said in Eastern Europe. In communist countries, you're hungry, you're scared, and you're quiet. You become just another automaton saying, yes, sir, no, sir. And that's what the communists wanted. Bill Bethlen pointed out that the average housewife in Eastern Europe spent 35 hours a week queuing. 35 hours a week. That's 5 hours a day, 7 days a week, out with an empty basket waiting to get into the shop. And why? Waste people's time. I mean, I see it every day. I drive past City Hall traffic departments on in Pounds. You just see long rows of people queuing. Why? Governments like to be inefficient and waste people's time. Got less time to organize counter-revolution, I guess. Diesel prices have skyrocketed, making farming even more difficult because tractors tend to be diesel-run, while simultaneously making the food that does get delivered more expensive to deliver. So farming costs are going up because diesel prices have gone up. Notice petrol's coming down, but diesel is not coming down. I'm sure you've noticed that. A fertilizer shortage is not helping things either. The mainstream media and the ruling class are hell-bent on enslavement, and they continue to lie and blame the conflict on Ukraine. Oh, conflict in Ukraine, on Russia, that is. A conflict they're all part of, and they're fueling. With every passing day, the globalists are tearing down something else that's essential to keep the economy running. Pipelines, international trade, railways, baby formula, manufacturing. Week after week, the food collapse intensifies while the food prices rise. The end result is obvious. No farmers, no food. Widespread food scarcity is coming, combined with sky-high prices that few will be able to afford. That's the plan. And this isn't just a theory. They've written about it. This is part of the Great Reset. This is Klaus Schwab's been speaking about this for a few years now. World Economic Forum supporters have taken steps to guarantee a coming global food crisis. And you can see it going on right now in the Netherlands with Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who's a global young leader of Klaus Schwab, one of his pals, along with Zelensky, along with Ramaphosa, along with Justin Trudeau and Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand. They're all World Economic Forum stooges, completely sold on the agenda. And that's why they're working in the Netherlands right now to basically close down half the farms and kill half the cattle of the country. That's very important in agriculture. Every measure that the Biden administration strategists have been making to control energy inflation has damaged the supply, inflated the price of natural gas, oil, and coal to the global economy, increasing some by 300%, others by 400%. In Europe, some energy sources have gone up 700%, even some up to 800%. So, what did Biden campaign on? Build back better. Nothing is built, nothing is back, and nothing is better. These people never built anything. So, Donald Trump raised the bar. Kamala Harris failed the bar. AOC worked at a bar. Old Nancy Pelosi lives at the bar. Biden can't spell the bar. And Hillary Clinton should be behind bars. That's sort of one way of looking at politics. Now, this has all had a huge impact on fertilizer prices and food production. And this began long before the war in Ukraine. You can't blame this all on Russia and Ukraine. Biden's people intervened to stop and block the freight rail shipping of fertilizer at the most crucial time, just before the spring planting, and effects continue to be disastrous. At the crucial time when they were about to be planting all over America, the largest supplies of nitrogen fertilizers were suddenly forbidden, prevented, blocked from using the railway system in Union Pacific would not carry their fertilizer. And this basically prevented thousands of farms, tens of thousands of farms, from sowing their crops in time or having the fertilizer that they needed to complete spring applications. And this is jeopardizing the farmers' harvest. It's increasing the cost of food for the consumers. This couldn't have been accidental. Their ban affected nitrogen fertilizers, urea, all of this, things that are also essential for diesel trucks, which is also increasing diesel fuels. And the places that were the biggest producers of this all got hit. They were the ones being targeted. And this is part of the 2007 U.S. Renewable Fuel Standards Act, which mandated raising targets for production of corn for ethanol fuel blends. So biofuels have captured 40% of America's corn acreage. Must be, so that's what used to produce food, now must be for fuel. What's the result? Price of food has gone up. Corn is now in less supply because they, by law, have to be designating 40% of the corn that used to be grown for food for fuel now, for biofuel. And on every area, the White House has sent corn prices through the roof. They know what they're doing. This isn't stupidity. This is deliberate. Now, American corn is at a 10-year high. Exports from Russia and Ukraine, major sources for the world, are blocked by sanctions and by war. So apart from the energy inefficient use of corn for biodiesel, the latest initiative is just going to add to the growing food crisis around the world, and it's not going to do anything to lower the price of fuel in the United States. Now, a major use of American corn is also as food for domestic animals, cattle, pigs, poultry, and or even for human diet. So the cynical idea of redirecting massive amounts, millions of acres of farmland for fuel is going to lead to more starvation, actually. And it's all part of a zero carbon agenda. So basically, the American administration, USDA, they actually are waging a war against fuel. And they ordered chicken farmers to kill off millions of chickens because they allegedly found some evidence of bird flu. And this H5N1 bird flu virus was exposed in 2015 as a complete hoax. The test used by the US government inspectors to determine whether they have bird flu is the same unreliable PCR test that detected COVID in humans, which I found out was 95% ineffective and false positives anyway. It was never designed for that. It doesn't matter. It's worthless. But they killed millions of chickens for no good reason and destroyed them without allowing them to be sold for food. This is the kind of evil governments we've got out there. Since the first cases were tested positive in February, at least 23 million chickens and turkeys were killed, they call it culled, to allegedly contain the spread of a disease whose cause may not have been bird flu at all. It could have just been an incredibly unsanitary cage confinement of mass industrial chickens. And the upshot is increased prices of eggs, severe loss of chicken protein, and cost of living at a 40-year high. To make matters worse, there's droughts in many key parts of the world, including California and Oregon. U.S. food security is under threat as never before, worse than any time since the Dust Bowl Depression of the 1930s. And the Biden administration's green agenda is doing everything it can to make the impact worse for its citizens. So, so-called President Biden remarked, without elaborating, that U.S. food shortages are going to get very real. America's never been short of food before. This is new. He's deaf to the pleas of farm organizations to allow the cultivation of some 4 million acres of good farmland, which is just not allowed to be cultivated for environmental reasons, whatever that means. And this is not the only part of the world where the crisis in food is developing. These are deliberate actions by WEF players in order to create a massive, colossal, accumulative food crisis around the world. Probably the worst food crisis in the Second World War, real starvation coming to places like even Europe. In the EU, which is significantly dependent on Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine for their feed grains, their fertilizers, their energy, sanctions are making the COVID-induced food shortages dramatically worse. And the EU is using the green agenda as an excuse to limit state aid to farmers and beating up on farmers Just like our government hostile to farmers, many EU governments, like the Dutch government, are hostile to their farmers. In Germany, the new Green Party of Agriculture Minister Cem Özdemir wants to phase out traditional agriculture, allegedly for greenhouse gas emissions. He's told farmers want to grow food. He's given them a pretty cold response, basically, you know, move on to eating bugs. And they're not, that's not a joke. They're seriously producing films telling you that you should be eating locusts and bugs and cockroaches and so on. That's serious. They really want us to move off meat onto eating insects. Bizarre. I mean, you can tell them to go eat bugs. The EU faces many of the same disastrous threats to food security as America, especially because they're very dependent on Russian energy, which they are suicidally sanctioning. Major food production companies in South America, Argentina, Paraguay, in the midst of a severe drought. Sanctions on Belarus and Russia on their fertilizers are threatening Brazil crops, which also have bottlenecks in ocean transport. China has had severe rains, and as a result, this year's winter wheat crop is going to be the worst in their history. Shanghai, the world's largest container port, has been under bizarre COVID zero total quarantine for months, causing massive backlog. Africa is also severely impacted by the American-imposed sanctions and war in Ukraine, ending food and fertilizer exports from both Russia and Ukraine. 35 African countries get their food from Russia and Ukraine, especially wheat. And Ukraine's been a major producer of wheat, and the wheat areas are some of the main war-affected zones. 22 African countries import their fertilizers from Ukraine and Russia. So alternatives are seriously lacking. Prices are soaring, supplies collapsing, bottlenecks at ports, some totally shut down. Famine is coming. No farmers, no food, no future. I mean, this is pretty basic. The Dutch farmers are really rising in the Netherlands. This is just phenomenal. The resistance in the Netherlands is, but it has to be. The government of Mark Rutte wants to close down 11,500 farms. And they want half of their cattle killed. Of course the farmers are going to complain. Do you know, in Germany, farmer groups are upset over the Renewable Energy Act passed by government, so-called renewable energy. Polish cultivators are protesting the cost of fertilizer. Italian and Spanish farmers are facing increased fuel prices and skyrocketing costs. You wonder why they've changed their government in Italy. The Netherlands is the largest exporter of meat in Europe, the second largest exporter of food overall after the United States. That's a small country. Amazing, a remarkable feat for a nation just half the size of Indiana. Very high quality farming. I mean, the Boers in South Africa and the farmers in the Netherlands must be some of the most innovative, hardworking farmers on the planet. And what they're producing is phenomenal, and it's bringing in $100 billion a year in revenue for the Netherlands. Well, Mark Rutte wants to cut that by half. Why? Because he believes nitrogen and fertilizers poisoning the soil. Experts attribute the nation's success to its farmers' embrace of technological innovations. And according to the farming lobby, LTO Netherlands, there's nearly 54,000 agricultural businesses or farms in Netherlands. The exports in euros are 94.5 billion, just in 2019. The Dutch farmers say they're being very unfairly targeted as polluters. Because the other industries like aviation, construction, transport, they contribute far more to emissions and they're not facing such severe rules. The Polish farmers are taking to the streets of Warsaw shouting, enough is enough, we will not allow ourselves to be robbed. We workers cannot pay for the crisis created by politicians, which is true. The Scottish Farmer magazine reports that supermarkets are running out of food as protests continue to intensify. This is all over Europe. There are shortages coming. Fishermen have been blocking ports, several ships honking the horns to express discontent over inflation and the targeting of farmers. German farmers blockaded roads on the border with the Netherlands, gathered in large numbers to protest near the city of Herenburg. No farmers, no food. You would think people could get this in their minds, but when you ask some people, where do you think food comes from? They say from the store. And at the same time, Europe is facing an invasion of migrants, most of them Muslims, pouring in from North Africa and the Middle East, and swamping parts of Europe. And Italy has faced the brunt of it. And This is why Italy's just changed its government. And you can imagine, Britain is facing 1,000 migrants a day crossing the Channel, and the Royal Navy is helping them to cross. Instead of taking them back where they came from or sinking them, making them walk the plank or something, they bring them into Britain and housing them in hotels. Now, Britain does have homeless people, by the way, but don't worry about them. This is Camelot Castle Hotel in Cornwall. This is where Camelot began. This is the King Arthur legend. This is the number one tourist destination in the Victorian era. And so the owner of Camelot Castle Hotel had his secretary come and say, the Home Office has been in touch and wants to rent their hotel for £1 million for the next year. £1 million for a year, but they take over the whole hotel. Now, their hotel rooms are £257 a night. £257 a night. You don't want to know what that is in rands. They want to put migrants there, Muslim illegals who've crossed the Channel in dinghies. They wanted there for a year, with free Wi-Fi, of course. And they said, by the way, you can fire all your staff except three. We only need three. They only need to clean the rooms and so on, like once a week. And they said, but this is a historic site. We've got antiques. We've got irreplaceable works of art. What if they're damaging these things? And the Home Affairs people said, don't worry, just take pictures. We'll cover the cost. Well, how can you replace irreplaceable works of art and original oil on canvas paintings and so on? Now, there's people in their very community who are starving, who can't afford food, and who will not be able to afford to switch on electricity at all in the coming winter. But the UK government can continue. It's meant to be a Conservative government, by the way. I don't know what that means in Britain these days. But they just let the migrants come 1,000 a day and we're just going to house them in hotels. Why not army barracks? Why not tents? They put us in tents in the army. Why should migrants be put in four-star hotels? But anyway, can you trust your government? War on food, war on fuel, war on faith and freedom. We have just gone through an injection of fun. This vaccine is going to save your life. I mean, honestly, these COVID cult pastors who... And you know your government loves you and cares for you. I mean, you know, when they drag you out, beat you up, kick you in the face and beat you over the head with truncheons, what more can they do to show they're really concerned about your health and well-being? And this is the face of the New World Order. Boot on the neck. This is because you don't want to mask up. Don't you understand? We care about your health. So no mask, no jab. She's still healthy. Do we need any more evidence of witchcraft? I mean, be honest. The politicians' elite lied to you, and we should start getting mad about this. This is like burning people at the stake in the Middle Ages. You are an enemy of the state. You've committed blasphemy and treason because you doubt that masks are going to save you, lockdown's going to save you, salvation by vaccination. And so they've been doing all this to us. The same person who said we need to depopulate the world suddenly wants to save you and extend your life expectancy with his vaccines. We don't trust the science. We do trust science, but coercion is not science. Withholding data is not science. Manipulating data is not science. Cherry-picking studies is not science. Social conditioning is not science. Fear-mongering is not science. And censorship most certainly is not science. And the evidence has now come out. Pfizer knew they didn't work. They'd never even tested to see if they would prevent spreading of COVID. And it's all coming out now in the Senate hearings. And Pfizer's admitting they knew it wouldn't work even before they released them. They knew it was dangerous. They even knew it was danger to heart attacks and strokes. They knew before they even released it, but they invested so much in it, you know. It's actually futile to try to talk facts to people who are enjoying a sense of moral superiority in ignorance. So said Thomas Sowell. Hosea 4 verse 6 says, my people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. And one day many will hang their heads in shame when they realize the evil they've defended and the heroes that they've ridiculed. I think some of the most tenacious people of integrity are the people who've resisted the inoculations and resisted the brainwashing during this time of insanity over the last 2.5 years. George Orwell called them thought police. Zuckerberg calls them fact checkers. I never had fact checkers till the truth started getting out there. And so we're now heading into this George Orwell predicted 1984 with Thought Police, and it's called by the World Economic Forum the Great Reset. And the European Union is the epicenter of this. They even built their parliament in Strasbourg to model the incomplete structure of the Tower of Babel, even with the scaffolding and incompleteness of the building. How can we best understand the times and use the crisis for the advancement of the kingdom of God and the fulfillment of the Great Commission? Our friends in Europe are heading for some dark and cold times in this coming winter. It's been rotted from the inside by Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was a founding member of the Communist Party of Italy, and he is part of Frankfurt School, and he said, Lenin got lucky. We're not going to get the same correlation of forces. We will not take Western Europe by revolution or by force. It's too Christian. We have to take a several generation long march to the institutions of the West, and we must act like termites to rot the insides of the structures, the pillars of the society. We've got to rot it so that even if they put whitewash on the outside, it's all going to collapse one day because we've rotted the insides of education, entertainment, news media, religious institutions, political institutions. And he was added to the Frankfurt School by Herbert Marcuse. And Herbert Marcuse says, we must introduce ugliness into art and meaninglessness into music. And we must introduce a celebration of every violation of the Ten Commandments into entertainment. We must use obscenity, vulgarity, and blasphemy as verbal grenades against the bourgeois. We've got to make it normal for people to swear and to think to use the different words of thinking obscenities and blasphemies and words like that. And Herbert Marcuse, by the way, was named by Hillary Clinton as the most formative influence in her life. And Antonin Gramsci, by the way, was named by Bill Clinton when he became president. Asked, who's been the most formative thinker in your life? And he said, Antonio Gramsci. The Gramsci strategy is also called the termite strategy, rotting the insides of a society until it collapses, just like you can imagine termites have eaten through a wooden building and one day the whole thing just collapses. We need to be like the sons of Issachar who had understanding of the times and knew what Israel, what God's people should do. Back in 1776, Adam Weishaupt, Mayer Rothschild, and Jacob Frank launched the Illuminati with the long-term political goals of abolition of all monarchies and all governments, abolition of private property and inheritances, abolition of nationalism, abolition of the family and the institution of marriage, abolition of all religion, establishment of compulsory communal education for all children. Now, if you've read Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto of 1848, you'll immediately recognize the Illuminati agenda of 1776, which is the same as the Sabbatean agenda of 1666, is clearly articulated. And if you look at our governments today, this is what they're doing. This is what Darwinism, Marxism, this is what Satanism, the Illuminati, the globalists are all working towards. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, blasphemies. Everyone will deceive his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. They weary themselves to commit iniquity. The New World Order has used wars, economic depressions and recessions, population control to undermine Western civilization, to bring about the globalist agenda. Through aggressive population control tactics, through promoting birth control, abortion, sterilizations, massive propaganda of overpopulation, the globalists aim to dramatically bring down the population of Europeans and Americans, traditionally being the Christian missionary sending bases, and then by betraying stable governments in Africa and Asia and South America, bring about economic collapse, vast movements of refugee populations being stimulated into Europe, North America, South Africa, Australia, dramatically decreasing population of those countries that are traditionally Christian, exploding the population of mostly pagan, anti-Christian races. The goal is a dramatic change in demographics and the death of the West. As this man so eloquently put it, be prepared for the real Holocaust. Europe, you will pay. Demolition is on its way. Behead those who insult Islam. While they promise him liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. This is documented. Black Book of Communism, Death by Government by Professor Rommel, In the Face of Evil, video on Ronald Reagan's war to win the Cold War to defeat the Soviet Union, the agenda films, very well worth seeing. Agenda 1, Agenda 2. Agenda 2 is even better because it focuses more on a solution. Psalm 94, verse 16 says, who will rise up for me against the wicked? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? That's why we believe in smashing cultural Marxism. Cultural Marxism is the Gramsci strategy, the Frankfurt School, working from the inside, rotting the soul of a society from inside. It's not accidental. It's not progress. It's degeneration. And we need to call it for what it is. And right now, the battlefield's in Europe. And Sweden's just ousted their EU government and voted in a centre-right party that is Eurosceptics. In other words, they want to pull out of Europe. And Giorgio Meloni, who committed treason, blasphemy against the New World Order by saying, I am a Christian, woman, mother, Italian. Four words. That makes her the worst, most evil person. Because, as she said, the globalists hate our identity. They want to swamp our identity. They only want us to be a number and a consumer and a slave. We are, and she went again, yeah. I am a Christian. I am a mother. I am a woman. I am an Italian. And you would swear that she's committed the worst crime. And she has, to the New World Order. And that's why they hate her. But she's the first popularly elected prime minister of Italy in 14 years. They are giving us all this nonsense, but they hate Christian nationalism. They hate it. And so the most radical thing you can do is love your family, be straight, get married, have lots of children, go to church, read the Bible. I mean, those are all the most rebellious things you can do to the New World Order. And remind them there's one way. Jesus is the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father except through him. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but out of power and of love and of a sound mind. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord. Depart from evil. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones.